Getting started with our conservation webinar, I'm Holly Kirkendall, National Technology Specialist for NRCS's East National Technology Support Center. I'm pleased to turn the webinar over to David Lamb. David is the National Soil Health Team Leader for NRCS's Soil Health Division. David, you may now begin.
Thank you, Holly. And again, this is David Lamb, and I appreciate everybody taking time out of their schedule today to participate. We've officially have the dog days of summer has started here in the southeast when we're getting that stretch of 90 degree plus with that lovely 90% humidity. So it's very nice to be inside out of that. Today's topic, I think, is just really timely with all the interest there is in soil health and how you assess it and those types of things and sending off lab samples and who can do what and where and what's beneficial. I just think today's topic on biological indicators of soil health, what are they, how they're measured, and what's coming down the road is so timely. And we couldn't have anybody better than our today's presenter, Dr. Jennifer Moore-Cuchera. Jennifer is our West Region Soil Health Team Leader. She's responsible for everything pretty much west of Kansas, I think, as far as that. And she's got an excellent staff out there to help her maintain soil health and expand its adoption as we go out there. Jennifer, before coming to work with us last fall in November of 2015, worked for the Texas Tech University for seven or so years. She was an instructor down there, but she also did some research that was related to those management options that are so important for positively influencing soil health living organisms, so that whole concept there. She's got her received her bachelor's degree in biology and environmental science from Binghamton University and there in New York. She got a master's from Iowa State and her PhD from Oregon. So she's been from one coast to the other getting educated. And with that, before I turn it over to you, Jennifer, I want folks to remember they can type their questions in and Jennifer's offered to answer a few questions as we go along the way. So make sure you do that. But with that, Jennifer, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, David. Got a little technical difficulty going on in the room, but I'm calling you from New Mexico. I'm actually out here on some field tours with our West Regional Soil Health Specialist staff. And so, without further delay, I'd like to thank everybody for joining this webinar. My goals for this presentation are to provide some technical examples of the important role that soil biology has in imparting numerous functions of soil health, and to give an overview of some lab-based indicators that are currently are used or are under consideration for use in a robust soil health assessment. This is simply an overview and is not intended to include all biological options or exclude any visual field observations or other chemical and physical indicators of soil health. It's just another piece in our soil health toolbox. And by the end of this webinar, I hope you will have a better appreciation for soil biology and some of the indicators that have great potential to help us make better informed management decisions. To begin with, I would like to emphasize the highlighted terms used in this definition of soil health. Soil health is a soil that functions as a vital living ecosystem. It is soil life and how we support and maintain that life that will be important to truly understand and adopt soil health management practices. And what I hope you gain from this presentation is that all of the functions that we're about to talk about all begin with life in the soil. This life in the soil is the foundation for helping soils produce food, fiber, fuel, and medicinal products. Important agronomic and other environmental functions in soil that we deem important include the ability of that soil to provide water to plants, resist disturbances and pathogens, regulate atmospheric gases important for climate change, and support efficient and internal nutrient cycling. The soil should also be able to degrade pollutants and keep it clean, and high-functioning, healthy soils will provide habitat to house and protect biodiversity. And although the last bullet on the slide identifies the soil as a habitat for this biodiversity, the soil biology truly is the life force that both directly and indirectly drives all of the above functions listed. Therefore, To understand soil health, we must understand soil biology and how this complex ecosystem functions. So in doing so, we will be able to better design systems that are more efficient, self-sufficient, and rely less on external inputs, and essentially allow the soil to achieve its fullest potential, or what we often refer to as soil health. So all of the functions listed on this slide start with the actions of the soil biology and their communities. Everything from the chemical properties of nutrient cycling to physical properties of aggregate formation and water flow and storage. So I'd like to just give a few examples of the importance of soil biology. As a professor back at Texas Tech, I would tell students, when in doubt, guess organic matter. Soil organic matter is one of the most important properties of soil because of all the physical and chemical properties it influences. However, what is often neglected is how this organic matter is formed. It's formed because soil organisms transform plant and animal residues into this organic matter. A sterilized soil cannot form organic matter. The life in the soil must be fed to increase organic matter levels to be able to have all of those positive chemical and physical impacts that are associated with it. And I am not able to stream the video, but I do provide a link. There's a great time-lapse video where you can actually see decomposition under some forest litter, and that link is provided in the slide. Soil aggregation, often considered a physical property, is also formed and stabilized due to the actions of soil microbes. Both fungi and bacteria are involved with physically enmeshing soil particles together, get the mouse, such as shown here in the scanning electron micrograph. It's a real high-powered microscope image showing the net-like fungal mycelia, or those filaments that wrap around like a hairnet and hold soil particles together. Bacteria also form filaments and bridge particles together, such as the lower right-hand corner figure showing filaments produced by specialized soil bacteria called actinomycetes. Finally, bacteria and fungi release sticky substances that bind particles together. And in this slide, we can see the bacteria are those rod and circular shaped structures on the slide, and these materials that are kind of oozing out of them are actually holding and sticky and bringing organic matter as well as sand, silt, and clay materials together. Without soil life, soil aggregates will not form. Of course, soil aggregates are then associated with physical and chemical properties, including increased oxygen and water flow and water storage, as well as the ability to resist the erosive forces of wind and water. But again, although physical in nature, it relies heavily on the biology. Soil fertility, typically considered a chemical property, is driven by soil life. As plant and animal residues are decomposed, the complex organic compounds are transformed by microbes to release inorganic soluble nutrients that are readily available for plant uptake. This process is called mineralization. From an agronomic perspective, it results in reduced fertilizer needs, but again, the life below ground must be fed to support this process and these important soil function. Further mineralization occurs as bacteria and fungi then become the food and are consumed by larger organisms, including springtails, mites, nematodes, and protozoa. This highlights the importance of the entire food web community in soil fertility and additional reductions in fertilizer needs in a healthy functioning system. In addition to mineralization processes that release plant available nutrients, one of the most fascinating processes soil bacteria perform is nitrogen fixation. Only bacteria are known to be able to take dinitrogen gas that's super strongly triple bonded together out of our atmosphere and convert it into ammonium under ambient conditions. Although there are bacteria that freely live in the soil that can do this amazing function, more commonly in agriculture, a symbiotic relationship forms between leguminous plant roots and special bacteria called rhizobia. And these systems, up to 200 pounds of nitrogen per acre, can be supplied by this natural nitrogen fertilizer factory. Lastly, relationships and biochemical communication between plants, microbes, and soil fauna help to stimulate plant growth and ward off pest and pathogen pressures. This complex biochemical communication system is just beginning to be deciphered by scientists and holds great potential to better tap into these natural defense and stimulatory functions. Plants have been known to release SOS signals that then translate into a response by bacteria or fungi to help ward off pathogen pressure. They can initiate the process of nematode trapping fungi to take out the nematodes that in this case are pathogens. They can release antifungal compounds or antimicrobial compounds that are all being communicated within this complex rhizosphere. And different plants release different chemical signals. And so we're just beginning to understand what triggers are being released as we incorporate and utilize different crop rotations into our systems. In fact, many communication systems have been shown to be more effective when, for example, arbuscular mycorrhizae are in conjunction with plant roots that helps those plants ward off drought or salinity issues. And these benefits are even more impactful than some of the genetic tests that have been done to modify plants. When all of these functions and relationships are working together, soil health is achieved and the system will be more efficient and rely less on outside inputs. This slide illustrates how we might be able to take traits from extensive and intensive systems that function well on some levels, such as high productivity in the intensive system, but poorly in others areas, such as low soil biodiversity in the intensive system. By combining traits from the intensive system with the extensive system, which might have high soil biodiversity and internal cycling, but low productivity, what the authors in this particular paper suggest is that we can achieve what's called ecological intensification. This system is characterized by high productivity that is supported by low to moderate resource inputs, a high rate of internal nutrient and biochemical regulatory processes, and low nutrient losses. By understanding that the soil is an ecosystem that does not work in isolated boxes, but rather as an integration of biological, chemical, and physical properties, we can achieve these high-functioning, healthy systems. So how do we measure or monitor that the management decisions we choose are leading us toward this ecological intensification? A list of criteria considered to be important for soil health indicators is presented in this slide, and include that the indicator should cover a diverse set of soil biological, physical, or chemical functions or processes that are relevant to agriculture or ecological systems. The indicators must be sensitive to changes in soil and crop management systems and should reflect these changes within 1 to 3 years. And the indicator chosen and the methods used should be able to be adopted by commercial laboratories. Thus, they should be relatively easy to sample and measure for. They should be cost-effective and repeatable. And probably most importantly, the interpretation must be easily accessible by public stakeholders and guide management recommendations in the future. Biological indicators hold a lot of advantages in many of these criteria. What's lagging right now and is going to require some more research and a broader nationwide type of survey is to be able to gain interpretive power with these biological tests. But I believe that many of them hold great potential to help us guide management recommendations because of all of the important functions that are initiated by the soil life. So some of the advantages and disadvantages of biological indicators are listed here. Today I'm going to be focusing primarily on the microbiological indicators. Some of the advantages are that these indicators are extremely sensitive to management. They can reflect changes sometimes within months, but certainly within the first year or so. At the flip side of this, they are highly sensitive to both seasonal and temporal variability, and sometimes, depending on the method, can be too sensitive and respond to environmental variables such as soil moisture and temperature. And that's where the need to design tests across different climates, different soil types, different regions, under different systems, need to be established to identify those thresholds under a variety of conditions. One of the main advantages is that microorganisms, because of all of those functions I just shared with you, can be indicators of multiple chemical and physical properties. And although there are many methods require advanced skills and are still relatively expensive, the costs are decreasing as technological advances are made and the methods are becoming more streamlined for future commercial adoption. And what's really exciting is that this field of soil microbial ecology is highly expanding, and there's an immense knowledge base of unknown potential just waiting to be explored. Now that we've covered why soil biology is important and some of the current and future advantages that biological indicators may hold for soil health assessments, let's discuss a few approaches used by researchers in some commercial labs. Basically, microbial indicators of soil health fall into one of three categories: abundance, composition, and activity. The first one is microbial abundance or biomass. You can see with the numbers presented here that life in the soil truly is extremely abundant, holds great mass, and is very complex. It is this complexity, however, and vast abundance that creates some challenges for soil microbiologists to make sense of, and has been a major hurdle to overcome in the lab. One of the most common biological soil quality measures used in the literature, with literally thousands of publications, involves estimating the microbial biomass. There are numerous methods, but one of the most common involves chloroform fumigation. This method basically fumigates the soils, that kills microbial cells. The cells essentially burst or lysed open. And then we can measure the amount of carbon or nitrogen, phosphorus, or sulfur that is released upon cell rupture, and then use a simple equation to calculate the mass of the microbial community. In general, microbial carbon accounts for 2 to 5% of the total organic carbon found in soil. Although small in mass, don't forget about the punch these microbes pack in performing all of those important soil functions. The microbial cells also contain substantial amounts of nitrogen, up to 50 pounds of nitrogen per acre, and thus contribute to soil fertility when they die and are decomposed and mineralized. And changes in the size of the microbial pool has great advantages of some of the other chemical properties because they show up much sooner than changes in the total organic carbon pool, making it a very sensitive indicator of future increases to that ever-important organic matter content. An example showing the sensitivity is shown with this figure, where microbial biomass was shown to increase 16% in just 1 year following the conversion of monoculture cotton to forage sorghum grown for biofuel. This occurred in a very sandy soil with more than 80% sand that contained less than 0.4% organic carbon. Only the biological tests used in this study reflected changes due to management. No other chemical or physical tests conducted showed any change, highlighting how biomass estimates can provide a glimpse into what may come in the future. Another way to use biomass data is to calculate what percent biomass carbon is relative to total organic carbon. In general, we want more than 3%, but the fact that we saw an increase from 2.2 to 2.6% after just 1 year is very encouraging, and it indicates that organic matter and all the associated functions will increase with time. So sometimes we're just not looking at the right indicators to be able to reflect these changes in management. And these systems were under tilled systems, both the cotton and the sorghum. And by coupling that with more minimized disturbances, we can increase these levels at a faster rate. Biomass carbon, like most biological indicators, is influenced by inherent soil properties and climate, in addition to management shifts. This figure is from the Australian government and they've begun to suggest some thresholds of biomass measurement shown here with levels below 100 milligrams per kilogram soil and the red and needs improvement, with ideal conditions being over 300 milligrams of carbon per kilogram of soil. What's interesting and what we need to keep in mind is that we can't forget about our basic soil science properties and the influence of these on establishing these thresholds. So potential microbial biomass is driven by soil type, where increasing clay will increase microbial biomass, but decreasing soil depth will have the converse effect. What's attainable is then driven by rainfall and temperature, with increasing rainfall and lower temperatures supporting higher biomass. But the actual microbial biomass, and this is where we have impact, is through the management. And so by choosing systems that incorporate legumes, pasture, no-till, and compost additions, we can expect increases in that microbial biomass pool. And similar to what the ARS scientists have shown in what they've used as the soil management assessment framework, the Australians also recommend increases of 3% or more of the microbial biomass making up that total organic carbon. But even lower ratios can be useful so long as there's an increase over time, as I just showed in the previous slide. Another category of microbial soil health indicators is to use biochemical markers such as lipid profiling, or more recently with molecular sequencing techniques, to characterize the who is in the community and what that composition looks like. There is great potential of sequencing efforts, and recent advances in technology are continuously improving the resolution and lowering the cost, which will be something to watch for in the near future. But currently, some labs are offering lipid profiling approaches to characterize microbial community composition and structure, and it's the topic of the next few slides. So one of the lipid profiling techniques that is available is called phospholipid fatty acid profiles, or PLFAs. So what are these things called phospholipid fatty acids? They're essential cellular components that help form a protective layer around cells. They're composed of a phosphate group at one end, called the head, and two fatty acid tails at the other end. And the head is hydrophilic and the tails are hydrophobic, so that in this figure up here, you can see they form this lipid bilayer. And basically, it dictates what can pass into and out of the cell, helping to protect it. What's interesting and why it's useful as a tool in microbial community structure is that all microbes contain these phospholipid fatty acids, and depending upon the chemical composition of these fatty acid tails, they can be used as biomarkers of a whole array of different microbial groups. Additionally, the PLFA technique is nice because this phosphate group is degraded quickly upon cell death. Thus, the PLFA method targets the viable, or that living, microbial community. So what does it mean? What are these tails indicating, and how can we use it to interpret management? So there are two different types of bacteria that markers have been shown with this analysis. One is biomarkers for what are called gram-negative bacteria, as well as gram-positive bacteria. The gram-negative bacteria tend to be fast growers. They respond rapidly to fresh inputs. They tend to increase with increased organic matter and are higher in the rhizosphere relative to gram-positive bacteria. The gram-positive bacteria, on the other hand, are slow growers. They're more resistant to environmental stresses or nutrient deprivation. The way I kind of think about them, I think that the gram-negatives are like the tourists. They come in and their populations explode under nice, sunny, warm conditions when all the restaurants are open. Whereas the gram-positive, they're like the local residents, that they stick around when all the weather turns bad and the restaurants close up, and they kind of keep things going under the less ideal conditions. And so we can use these markers and the ratio of gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria to indicate whether carbon is readily available and whether it's occurring in systems. There are specialized gram-positive bacteria called actinobacteria, or formerly actinomycetes, These are the guys, you've probably have smelled them in your soil. It's what imparts that nice, earthy, rich smell that soils give off when these organisms are degrading that complex organic matter. They're also involved in aggregation through forming filaments that bridge particles together that I already shared with you. And these organisms tend to be dominant under high salinity conditions, high pH, or low moisture conditions. And again, you can use the gram-positive to gram-negative ratio to give you an indication of carbon status. So the higher the ratio tends to be associated with lower carbon content in organic inputs. And therefore, high ratios are more common in cultivated soils compared to grasslands. Similar to bacterial markers, there are certain fatty acid tails that are specific or somewhat unique to fungal markers. And so we can get saprophytic fungal markers as well as ectomycorrhizal fungal markers. These are the same biomarker. The saprophytic fungi are important in degrading organic matter, especially complex organic matter like lignins and things that are harder to break down. And they tend to be higher in systems with lower pHs. The same marker can also be used for ectomycorrhizal fungi. These fungi are associated in that symbiotic association with woody species. And because the same biomarker works for both, you have to know which system you're investigating for better interpretation. So in cropland systems, typically this marker is good for the saprophytic fungi. Probably one of the best or most sought after markers is that for arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. This is because of their known importance in numerous soil functions, including aggregate stability and enhancing phosphorus and water uptake by plants in low water and high pH soils. Additionally, these organisms have been associated with helping protect plants from a variety of stressors, including salinity and pathogens. And so this particular marker and the ratio of arbuscular mycorrhizae to fungi can give a good indication of soil health improvements. Also, there are markers that are used for protozoa, but some of these are also markers for nematodes. Regardless of whether we're isolating protozoa or nematodes, both of these groups are predatory organisms that are important in nitrogen mineralization and population control. And so they can still be useful regardless of which taxa it's highlighting. So some of these, I'll share with you an example of PLFAs and how they've been used in one of our studies from my time at Texas. But I just want to point out that there are some cautions that we need to be aware of with PLFAs. And the main one is that the values are dependent upon the method and instrumentation configuration. So as we move forward, if we adopt this particular biological indicator, we need to make sure the labs are doing it all the same way under the same conditions, because by changing those conditions, you can get very different results. One is not necessarily better than the other, but it means you can't compare across labs. And also to point out that the biomarkers are guides. These are not absolute indicators. And so there's some overlap, and the groups don't always track in the same direction. And we're still learning about cultured organisms, and all of the interpretation of these biomarkers are based on culture studies. So as sequencing efforts come online, we can gain more confidence in what the biomarkers are showing. Currently, use of PLFAs in soil health tests are best used for comparison. So you have a system, you change that management strategy, and you want to know whether you're improving and increasing or changing that community, that microbial community. If you're changing that microbial community, if you're increasing arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, if you're decreasing that gram-positive, gram-negative ratio, you can have more confidence that you'll have downstream positive impacts on the functions of nutrient cycling, of aggregation and resistance and resiliency. So here's an example of a study that a PhD student at Texas Tech is still working on. This is in a long-term CRP study where the CRP land had been converted back to annual cropland, primarily cotton. Within 5 years following conversion, Lee found a 61% reduction in AMF markers and a 39% increase in gram-positive markers. So this is, and we've also have some data that show that these changes are occurring on a much shorter time frame, even within the first few years. These results translated into a significant decline in the ratio of Arbuscular mycorrhizal to bacteria, as well as an increase in the gram-positive to gram-negative ratio. Again, so this is an indication that soil degradation is occurring, and that the benefits imparted during the 25-plus years under perennial vegetation with CRP, we hypothesize that this will lead to soil degradation to a state lower than that observed when the soils went into conservation. These changes are all in advance of changes reflected by other properties, including organic matter. And so we can use the microbial indicators to give us some foreshadowing of what might happen in the future and then prevent those changes from occurring. Lastly, there are a number of microbial activities and active carbon sources that feed the microbes that are targeted as potential biological soil health indicators. Again, there are molecular tools that are on the horizon and may one day replace some of these, but those methods are still being developed and at the moment are too costly. So one approach is to look at the active carbon pool, which comprises anywhere from 5 to 25% of the total organic matter pool. This fraction is important because it's a source of food that feeds the microbial community and has been shown to be sensitive to management practices. As a contrast to the passive pool, which makes up the majority of the total organic matter pool, and is important for chemical and physical properties, including water holding and cation exchange capacity. But this pool can take decades to reflect changes, and by measuring the total organic matter, this large component of the passive pool may overshadow the more subtle changes to the active pool that initiates microbial processing and starts the path towards soil health. So there are a number of ways to evaluate the active carbon pool. One approach has been used by the Cornell Soil Health Test and is called potassium permanganate oxidation test, or KMNO4. The potassium permanganate works because it's a strong oxidizing agent. Hydrogen peroxide is a common oxidizing agent you may be familiar with. This potassium permanganate has a purple color that changes when it reacts with labile or easily decomposable forms of organic matter. During the reaction, that purple potassium permanganate is oxidized and becomes lighter in color. The color change is then measured, and the amount of carbon oxidized is calculated. And again, the amount that's oxidized represents that active pool that's feeding the microorganisms. So in general, higher values are warranted. So there have been a few publications that question the utility of this test, and that's probably true for just about any soil test, not including chemical and physical properties. Because active carbon by this method doesn't always correlate with microbial biomass or other labile pools. But what has been reported in a more recent article in 2012 by Coleman et al. Is that this pool actually does reflect that active fraction, and it is very sensitive to management. And as this test is used across different geographic and climate and other soil inherent properties and under different systems, we can better identify thresholds of what good, better, and poor values are. So as an example of its sensitivity is shown in this figure, based on some preliminary results from colleagues at Texas Tech and Texas AgriLife Research Center. In this case, active carbon was about 2 times higher in the reduced till systems that included a cover crop compared to conventionally tilled cotton systems shown here, but that they found no statistical difference between the two cover crop systems. And this was on a LAMESA soil health study and had been in place for 18 years. Another way to measure microbial activity is to track how much carbon dioxide is produced by the microbial community as they decompose plant and animal residues and form organic matter. The burst, it's typically done following the rewetting of a dried soil sample, and the amount of CO2 that's released, usually measured after one or a few days of incubation, reflects the abundance and activity of the soil microbial population. And the amount released is related to the quantity and quality of organic matter, as well as nutrient availability through mineralization processes. So how we measure it, again, we take air-dried soils, we re-wet them, and they're incubated anywhere from 24 hours to 28 days. 28 days is usually in the research laboratories. In the commercial labs, there are two that are currently available. The Solvita Soil Burst uses a 24-hour incubation. They trap that CO2 on a proprietary gel paddle that turns color, and then that paddle is then read on a reader and related back to the amount of CO2 that was released. The Cornell Soil Health Test uses a similar approach, but they incubate their soils for 4 days, and then they measure the amount of CO2 that's released by changes in the electrical conductivity of a base trap. Regardless of which way you measure this method or the CO2 that's released, it does again provide an indication of how abundant and active that microbial community can be. Some cautions, as with all, that some the soil respiration tests don't account for microbial or ecological stress. And so we can get pretty high values following a disturbance, such as tillage, harvest, fire, or clear cutting. So there are some ways to kind of deal with this, and that's where using a battery, an array of tests, comes in handy. So we can couple CO2 with something like microbial biomass or total organic carbon, and we can get an indication of the quality of that organic matter that's being degraded or whether microbes are under stress. A high ratio, which would mean high carbon dioxide production without an increase in microbial biomass carbon, suggests the community is stressed. They're basically in maintenance mode and survival mode, and they're putting energy into just staying alive rather than building biomass and multiplying. And so the high ratios indicate that organic carbon loss is greater than organic carbon formation and can be used. And then similar to the active carbon, this is the same test where we had about 2 times higher CO2 burst in the reduced tilled systems with cover crops compared to the conventionally tilled cotton production. The last one I'd like to share with you is something that's being considered. It's enzyme activities. And enzymes are really important in driving nutrient cycling, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur cycling, as well as the degradation of a lot of pollutants. Enzymes are simply proteins that increase the rate of reaction while not being consumed themselves. So in this figure at the bottom shows a cartoon of an enzyme where a substrate comes in, and it must fit in perfectly like a key in a lock. When that bond is made, then the enzyme goes to work, the bonds in the substrate are weakened, and products are released. But the enzyme remains intact and able to work on the next set of substrates. In soils, these enzymes help increase how quickly plant residues decompose and release of plant nutrients. So one of the more common ones is something called beta-glucosidase, and it is involved in breaking down cellulose, which is just a whole bunch of glucose sugars chained together. And this enzyme releases single units of glucose. And glucose is sort of a uniform or universal energy source of microbes, so as this glucose is increased in the soil, it's going to support and stimulate more microbial activity and has been used as a sensitive indicator in soil quality studies. And then this is just a slide to, again, emphasize that that's just one enzyme that I gave you an example of, but there are numerous others involved in other breakdown of cellulose, chitin, and other carbon-containing compounds. The degradation of lignin and complex organic matter can be monitored. And more specifically to nutrient cycling is phosphorus cycling enzymes, sulfur cycling enzymes, and nitrogen cycling enzymes. The nice thing about this test is that they can be conducted on air-dried soils, are very sensitive to management changes, and and are related directly to the release of nutrients. So similar, this is the enzyme data from where I showed you we had a 16% increase in microbial biomass as we transitioned just 1 year following monoculture cotton to forage sorghum grown for biomass. And we found that in five out of the six enzymes, we had increases anywhere from 17 to 75% increase in enzyme activities, especially phosphorus cycling. And by the way, that one was also related to increases in our arbuscular mycorrhizal markers. So it just goes to show none of the chemical properties that we tested or the physical properties that we tested were sensitive to detect these changes, but the biological indicators gave us this foreshadowing, and we call them kind of eco-sensors in the field. So similar to all biological tests, the individual numbers are challenging at this point, although data does exist for beta-glucosidase and is part of the soil management assessment framework from the ARS scientists. It's not currently available, but again, it's really quick, it's relatively inexpensive and easy for adoption. We do need to keep in mind that fertilizer applications may affect some of the activities, so we have to know history of the site and what's going on to be able to properly interpret them. And sample handling and storage may affect them, but less so than the tests such as phospholipid fatty acid or microbial biomass, where we need field moist soils to conduct those tests. Again, we can do this on air-dried samples, making it possible and increasing the ease of soil sampling and handling. So there again is future hope in molecular tools. We've just hit on the tip of the iceberg with biomass, microbial activities, enzyme assays, phospholipid fatty acid, but there's all these other techniques that are coming down the line that can give us real specific information about how management impacts the soil metagenome, for example. Do we need that level of specificity? Not sure. But there is some evidence that can suggest that by changing the communities and using keystone taxa or assemblages of microbes, we can have insight that the system is becoming more healthy or is in a degrading stage. And so I think down the line, some of these molecular tools will be useful. But in the meantime, we can still get pretty sensitive indications that we're on the right track as we change management practices. So I'd like to leave you with just this one last idea, that now that we're learning so much about the soil microbiology, there's literally terabytes of data that are coming in from sequencing efforts. And so there are some groups that are thinking, well, we need to manipulate that bacterial community. We need to genetically change it. We need to genetically change the plants to get the microbes to respond. But what I want us to consider, at least have a dialogue about, is that there's a wealth of information that already exists in ecosystems that are present today. And so the management practices and soil health principles promoted by NRCS really can help in every single one of these biological indicators and all of those important soil functions that we just described. By minimizing disturbance, by maximizing diversity, by protecting or maximizing the cover on the soil, and by providing living roots for as long as possible in our system, we help feed that system and let the biology and those bacteria and fungi and all the other organisms in the soil food web do what they've been designed to do for literally millions of years. And so what I'd like to encourage us is to look at these and learn how, by choosing different plants, we can stimulate different populations and decrease pathogen predation and have more optimal and more self-sufficient systems that can be designed. And I just also want to point out that a lot of these biological indicators I shared with you today are really good at detecting early changes. And so they might not be used in every system or in every soil health assessment, but when you're not seeing changes in some of the physical and chemical properties, but you feel like there's changes in your plant productivity or perhaps your yields or you're reducing inputs, these tests can help us identify that we're on that right track and can provide some indication of that and some confidence that the changes that we're implementing on the ground are moving in the right direction. And so with that, I'll finish up. I think we have time for questions. And again, just to emphasize, to understand soil health, we must understand soil biology and that it's an ecological system, and we have to understand the entire system and not forget about basic soil science and principles for accurate interpretation. And although currently a lot of these biological indicators are just directional, more is better, less is better kind of situations, with nationwide surveys, with benchmarks under standard protocols, we can develop the databases like has been used in Australia to identify those thresholds and be able to increase the interpretive power. And lastly, selection of management systems that allow nature to achieve full potential likely is the most efficient path to resiliency and self-sufficiency. And that really is it. I'd like to thank you for your attention, and we have time for questions, but please don't hesitate to contact me if your questions are not answered today.
Okay, Jennifer, wonderful job, and just want to remind folks that you can get a PDF copy of Jennifer's presentation, which I can see those slides being passed around quite a bit there, Jennifer. You had a very nice presentation there. So getting a lot of questions coming in about this. One question I had as you're going through the process, which of these are kind of commercially available, and what role does soil sampling, the actual collection and getting it to the lab play in all the results that you have of these things?
That's a really important consideration. And so I kind of go back to that definition of soil health. It's a vital living ecosystem. And so if we want to really tap into that potential and understand that living ecosystem, we have to treat it like it's alive. And so a lot of the biological indicators and tests, unfortunately, for ease of use, requires that we treat it a little bit more carefully. You have to keep the soil on ice. Yeah, you can't let it dry out except for the enzyme assays. And you need to ship it to a lab, within a day or two. And so that does add another layer of complexity. For people like myself, soil microbiologists, that's the way, I've never taken a soil sample that hasn't been done that way. And so it's sort of like just a perception and a mindset, and it really isn't that difficult. It just requires a little bit of education and a little bit of openness to try to make things work. And so I think it's possible. But sample handling and sample storage and shipping for trying to tap into that biological life is really important.
Okay. Got a couple questions about organic matter. Wouldn't high organic matter soil be healthy soils? Can you talk about that a little more?
Well, yes. In general, the more organic matter in the soil, the more it will provide home and habitat and food resources for the microbial life and increase infiltration and cation exchange capacity. I guess one of the things I was trying to point out is that the formation of that organic matter is biological in nature. And we sometimes often think of it just as a chemical or physical property in the soil. And then the other thing I wanted to point out is that, and we've had discussions even here today about how, some folks will take a soil sample and implement a management practice and say, well, it didn't change anything because organic matter didn't change. And that's because it takes time. That big passive pool that I talked about is sort of diluting out the effect that's really occurring kind of behind the scenes. And so we just need to take a different look and a different angle to try to identify that management is impacting and hopefully the changes that are being made are impacting in a beneficial way. And so these biological tests are really a great tool for that sensitivity and can help us, again, gain confidence that we are changing the system.
Okay. How applicable are these systems across land use, or these indicators, such as, we talk a lot about cropland, what about forest land or range land or even pasture land? Are they applicable under those conditions?
Microbes are everywhere. Yes. So I personally have conducted research in forests, croplands, rangelands, grasslands, pasture lands. You name it, you can do it.
Well, what about macro organisms such as insects? You showed some springtails and pillworms, those types of things. Can they be used at any stretch? Is there any thought about that in soil health assessments?
Yeah, and that's a great point. So the whole entire soil food web is important. I'll kind of make the disclaimer right up front. I am microbe-centric. It's been the extent of my entire career has been looking at the microorganisms. One of the reasons I like doing that is because they are so abundant, and they're really driving a lot of those nutrient processes. But that does not mean to say that the larger soil, meso, micro, macro fauna, are not important. And some of the molecular tools are actually being developed that can identify nematode population, and that is beyond just the pathogenic. You know, the majority of the nematodes in soils are good guys and contributing in very positive ways. And so there are some molecular tools that are coming down the line. And there are very traditional techniques we can also use. They're just very labor intensive. And they're just hard to deploy from a commercial adoption. That doesn't mean that they're not important. It just means that the techniques aren't really in alignment as well as some of the microbial tools that we use.
Yeah, it just seems, Jen, that we're trying to determine evaluating the habitat conditions that exist. You know, your last slide or two basically said if you build it, they will come. Is that kind of really what we're trying to do here?
Yes.
Yeah, rather than we get so hung up on what a standard soil test with N, P, and K, or P and K, and micronutrients, we have these values and stuff, and we really get hung up on the numbers. Do you see that being the same trend related to these types of assessments that you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what kind of questions you want answered, right? Currently, I think these kinds of indicators are really helpful in the early years or months of transition and can provide that, you know, level of confidence, like I mentioned. And I think that we can develop with comprehensive national surveys, we can get the thresholds and be able to interpret the numbers more precisely. I guess what I've, you know, it's and this is just sort of my personal opinion, is that all of these changes, again, start with the life in the soil, and for years and years, it's just been the researchers that have been looking at it and recognizing the importance of these organisms to all these soil functions. And so I think that part of maybe some of the reasons we haven't been able to move forward is because we've been ignoring the invisible. And I think by kind of recognizing, and you know, step one is just becoming aware. And so I hope, you know, in this presentation, you know, folks are just more aware of that biological life force that imparts all those physical and chemical properties. And so, you know, you have to know the system, you have to know soil properties, you have to know the history. And it's not something that you go into lightly. It does require, you know, a certain level of technical skill set.
So I'm a new producer, and I've been convinced to follow these principles. Do I need to do every field? And how do you go about? I've got, you know, fields that are 400 or 500 acres in size. I'm used to sampling by zones, you know, 15 to 30 acres in size. How would you establish a sampling protocol with that kind of concept, or under those kind of conditions, I guess?
Well, I've studied literally forested ecosystems and you know, CRP, hundreds, thousands of acres, and you just kind of go about it. There is a lot of spatial variability, and that is a concern. I guess I would argue that there's a lot of spatial variability in some of the chemical tests that we do, but we, you know, just deal with it. And so you do have to keep that in mind. But as far as the actual collecting of the soil sample, we do it the same way that we do for chemical tests. We take, you know, multiple samples and homogenize them to get a representation of that entire field or that section of the field. We try to, you know, sample different soil types separately or problem areas separately. And so some of the same concepts that we've used for years are applied to these biological sampling protocols. There was another part of that question, though, that you had. Do we have to do these?
Every field, yes, that's correct.
No, you don't have to do them. A lot of, you know, what I like about the biological indicators is that, again, these things show up more quickly than a lot of the other tests do. And so if you're a producer that's interested in kind of, you know, gaining that confidence, you're taking a risk by changing a management strategy, you want to know if you're on the right track, then it might be useful. You mentioned macroorganisms, and there are great ways that we can, you know, earthworms are, of course, a great tool to use out in visual observations. So it's part of the package, and it doesn't necessarily fit everybody's, you know, protocol, but it is an option that's available. You know, soil chemical tests are available to everybody, but I don't think everybody does those every year either, or every few years even. So it's just another layer that we can utilize to tap into, and it shouldn't be required for anybody, but it can be useful and helpful under the right circumstances.
Again, as most soil sampling, we're trying to identify problems and then gain confidence to make decisions in one way or another. And I guess one question I've kind of avoided, some of these tests actually kind of give you some recommendations or reveal maybe nutrient cycling that wasn't there before. You have any comments related to that, maybe words of caution, or have you had positive experience along the way?
I would say that the biological tests are kind of lagging behind the chemical and physical for that interpretation. Again, as I mentioned, in a lot of the tests, they're best used right now for comparisons, but, you know, ARS scientists and other folks across the country, as well as across the world, like I showed with the Australians, they've developed some thresholds and some, boundaries for interpreting these values themselves. But I don't think we can do that right now. We need to, you know, encourage different institutions to be able to support that kind of research to see how it plays out. You know, some of these tests might work great in certain areas but not so great in others. But we don't have as good of a handle on that as we do with some of the other tests. So there is a big window for opportunity there.
Okay, Jennifer. And I think people need to remember that soil testing came about in the 50s and 60s and has commercially gotten larger over the last several years. And I think we're kind of about that point in this whole concept of assessing soil health and how you can use it to make management decisions. And Jennifer, that's a wonderful presentation. I'm getting all sorts of great comments about it here in the questions and answers, but we're out of time. And with that, I want to thank you for your presentation. And you all have a great meeting out there in Portland. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Holly.
Thank you.
Okay, and I wanted to thank Jennifer as well, and thank you, David, for moderating the presentation today, and thanks to all of our participants for joining us. We had more than 450 people join today's webinar. Participants, to provide your feedback about the webinar, and if you selected to earn CEUs, please return to your open browser window to continue the process that's offered by Step 2 at conservationwebinars.net. And with that, this concludes our webinar presentation today. Thank you.